You are listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 184 for the week of August 15th, 2012.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to the Experience Points Podcast. My name is George Albor.
My name's Scott Juster.
And we are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a site dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of games and culture. Oh no, we're sitting here. We've got our... I got my glass of wine, Scott.
Got my tumbler of fine brandy.
And we are ready to discuss competitive gaming. In a way. So this week on the podcast, we are bringing you an article by the infamous, the notorious... Ian Bogost, and it's an article called In Defense of Competition on Sport Game Success and Failure. And this is an article that's really about competitive events as a whole. He talks quite a bit about Olympic events and goes off of a comment from one of his colleagues at Georgia Tech who writes that competitive gaming, or rather competitive events, and ostensibly gaming included, are somewhat less meaningful or more harmful than collaborative games and collaborative events. And Ian Bogost takes this concept to town. He sort of digs right in his classical, humorous, and very intelligent way. And we thought that this would make a good springboard for talking about both competitions in general, as well as the experiences that are unique to competitive gaming. Where do you think we should start with this, Scott?
Well... It's really, I mean, obviously it's highly philosophic since, you know, that's what he does, right?
Right.
But it's, I think the Olympics brought this into sharp relief because the Olympics are nice because since they only happen every 4 years, there's enough time for things to, like, social shifts to happen in between Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for a dumb example, like Twitter was a much bigger deal in 2012 than it was in 2008.
Right.
And, you know, in the gaming world, like cooperative play, co-op missions, team-based stuff continues to become more popular, I should say.
Yeah.
I mean, it was popular in 2008, but now it's even more popular in 2012.
Right. With such large amounts of connectivity, it's so easy to engage in that collaborative experience.
Right. And games, you know, in the current console generation, you know, like we're still kind of chasing the Gears of War. And now that is like a standard thing to have in shooters, you know?
Right. The Horde mode. I mean, Team Fortress 2 just announced Horde mode.
Right. So, I mean, like, it's interesting because we get these things like the Olympics that pop in every once in a while. And then they're a nice little contrast to what we've been doing ever so gradually, you know, because it's hard to notice things over the years and day by day, you know?
So you're suggesting that watching the Olympics reminds us that some people fail and fail hard.
Well, I mean, when else besides the Olympics do you see as hard failure on television?
Yeah, did you see, side note, did you see the diver fall on his ass in that diving competition?
I watched that video on YouTube approximately 5 times in a row. Because you never see that.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because... I mean, not that particular event is interesting, yes, but the Olympics overall are interesting because you get people who come out of the woodwork who are not normally into competitive events, passionate about these things, right? There are people who, out of nowhere, suddenly care about gymnastics, or they suddenly care about competitive swimming and Michael Phelps and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are so upset every time China takes the lead in total gold medal counts, right? Yeah. One of the most ridiculous competitions, meta competitions, if you will, of the entire event.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, ties into, you know, where the line is between collaborative victory and individual victory and failure, obviously. Because, you know, the Olympics have that meta layer on them as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, it's not just... Which is weird because... And I think Bogost, you know, he makes this point, albeit in a sort of like subtle way, but without individual competition, how could you possibly define success or failure on a broader scale, like on a collective scale? Like, how will you decide who gets to be in the collective of talented people without evaluating individual talent?
Right. Because no matter what, you know, if we were to imagine a collaborative gymnastics game or what have you, right, it is almost impossible to imagine a scenario where you can create your group of 10 or the women's gymnastics team of the United States were cleverly called, what, the Fab Five, I believe.
I think that happens, like, every Olympics, by the way. Like, it's always, like, Dream Team, Fab Five, you know.
Yeah,
like,
some clever name, right? Yeah. Like, decisions are made, and it upsets people, but I think Bogus would agree that that's sort of part of the process in order to get to the point where even the competition itself has this high amount of meaning, right?
Mm.
I think at one point he mentions the idea that some people might be upset by watching Weber, who's one of the female gymnasts, crying at the Olympics because of her poor performance, right? But would she have been as emotionally invested if she wasn't full of the competitive spirit at that time?
Right. Yeah, and that's, I think that's the best point to make, really. You know, it's reductive, but, you know, like, if you have to take huge risks and invest a lot in order to feel that alive sometimes.
Yeah.
I wrote about this pretty recently, actually. Like, I'm pretty sympathetic to this argument, because without consequences and without the possibility of something not turning out all right, I think things get dull.
Yeah. So the one thing I would say is someone leaves an astute comment, and I'm not entirely sure how true this is, but they refer to a book called No Contest by Alfie Kohn. I think that's the pronunciation.
Yeah.
That suggests that we can replace a lot of aspects of competitive games to make them collaborative or competitive against oneself without really affecting the entire game as a whole. Right? So theoretically, just to play the devil's advocate here, couldn't we imagine a scenario where Weaver's crying not because she lost in the competition amongst other great players of gymnastics, if you will, or that she's not, doesn't get to be crowned the winner over the entire world of gymnastics, but that because she didn't achieve her own personal goal, that she didn't do as well as she believed that she could do?
I think it's funny that gymnastics is one of the anchor examples here, because gymnastics is like that a lot. You know, like, there is theoretically a perfect run you could do, you know, in gymnastics, right?
Well, actually not anymore. And that's, I think that brings us to another point, is that I think that we also have to admit that, yes, even if we like competition and we favor competition for the type of experience that it can create, aren't, to some extent, all of the rules, by definition, going to be arbitrary regardless anyway?
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the point. Like, you can get so invested in a system of completely arbitrary rules that can be the only thing that matters. And within that context, winning and losing is important because that's how you measure meaning within the system.
Right.
And we can't really do that with our real lives, because it's just such an overly complex system, so many variables. You know, we need to block things off in order to really measure ability. But yeah. I don't know, like, maybe I must have missed out on some of, like, the changes or whatever, but, you know, like, you do a routine on the bars, and do they not start at, like, a perfect score or a perfect zero and then detract or add? Like, do they do something different now?
Sure. Let's talk about gymnastics.
Okay.
I only know this because my partner Nicole is, like, an ex-gymnast, and she takes watching gymnastics during the Olympics very, very seriously. But so the way it works now, as opposed to the way it used to work, is that your initial score is defined by your level of difficulty. So someone who's trying to do something that's very, very difficult might start out with a possible score of, say, 16.8, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas someone who's trying to do a routine that is less difficult starts out with a possible score of 15.8, right? Now, if you mess up on the very hard score, you could still mess up quite a bit and still score higher than the other person could have possibly scored, right? So, yes, theoretically, you could get a perfect score if you nailed your routine 100%, but at this point, that never happens. Mm-hmm. So there's not only is there no such thing as a perfect 10, but there's no such thing really as a perfect routine.
Because there's an incentive to push yourself a little bit beyond what you normally do, because the reward would be greater because you'd have a possibility of more points.
Yeah, precisely. Or you play the opposite game where you say, there's no way I can do that crazy triple lux the other person did. Right. I'm just going to settle for a lower score and try to do as well as I can in that ability.
That sounds kind of similar. I forget which game it was. Maybe it was maybe it was ice skating, or maybe it was like snowboarding or something like that. Like other games do, they grade on difficulty as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I find there's something different than competing against someone in a direct physical sense. Like, you know, take the USA basketball team or something, or yeah, to bring it back to video games, like take, you know, Thresh or Fatality from Quake fame or something.
Right.
Like competing against them is like, you're just not competing against a difficulty that you set up for yourself. Like there would be it'd be very hard to program a robot, or like to program like the difficulty of LeBron James's jump shot or something, and then compete against that, you know, without the yeah, actual presence of a competitor. Essentially,
you don't have like a ghost Mario to race against.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and that's always fun, you know, playing against your ghost, or playing against, you know, the computer programmed ghosts in Mario Kart is fun, but there's not as much dynamic content in that case.
Right.
And I think gymnastics is a little bit more reminiscent of that, you know, chasing the ghost basically.
Right.
Because you know, there's no, I mean, it's obviously a competition, but someone isn't trying to knock you off the bars, you know.
Scott, you may just have invented the best way to spice up gymnastics.
2016
since
Brazil.
The pommel horse. No, I think you're absolutely right. I do think that there's a level of competition in the fact that you're at such a heated event that mm-hmm. you've got to maintain not just a knowledge of your own routine and how you're going to execute it well, but a presence of mind to resist the pressure that comes with competing at the Olympic event.
So right? many people watching you. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Like I think that I'm really glad that we came to this, because I think that there is a difference between these three different types of competition, right? Mm-hmm. In my mind, you've got the thing that's gymnastics that's a little bit more akin to racing against your ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got one-on-one sports, say like table tennis, where it's you yeah. and one other person. And you know exactly that there's a winner and a loser in that scenario. And then you've got team sports, which I think are a whole other horse and pony show.
Right.
That's a term that I just said.
Horse, dog, pony, shark.
Because, you know, in that case, similar to gymnastics, there are aspects of the game that are out of your control, right? Like
yeah.
you might let the pressure get to you, or you can't determine how well your competitor plays. So yeah. you could do an absolute perfect routine, but if the person you're playing against starts out with a higher difficulty and messes up only a few times, you can still lose, right? Mm-hmm. I think that same sort of mentality takes place in team events, say volleyball, right? Where it's two team members. If your partner messes up, that's not on you, but you've still lost.
Right.
You know, and that type of competition, I think, has very different outcomes.
I'm always kind of perplexed by like the collaborative. I mean, like I know what they're getting at, but I feel like, you know, to have a truly collaborative game like that, you are just, you're going to be making up some goals for yourself. Like you need like a game designer who basically creates like a single player campaign for you, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's not, I guess that would standardize it, you know, over all competitors. Maybe you could argue that's a more realistic way of measuring talent. If measuring talent is even what you want to do. And it sounds like some, you know, the articles that Bogost references kind of want to throw that idea out, you know, wholesale.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's weird. I do think there's, I mean, I'm well documented on this. Like I do think there's value to failing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's value to like taking risks and like really giving yourself over to like all the rules in the system.
Right.
That, you know, that gets spread out when it's a collaborative experience, you know.
In a negative way, you're saying?
Well, yeah, it gets spread out in that, you know, it's if you are on a football team, or if you are part of a larger, you know, Counter-Strike team or something like that, something could always be you know, more beneficial or more detrimental that's completely outside of your control.
Yeah.
And so you don't have that singular focus on an individual's, like, we don't understand what makes an individual talented at something in a direct sense in that kind of situation.
But in these, I guess, for lack of a better word, collaborative competitive games like team volleyball or doubles volleyball, yeah. there's still a sense that you are covering for the other person's faults in some way, right? Like, these people aren't partners the day of and they're just randomly put together. They've been training for ages. They know where the other person lacks, right? Maybe they can't jump as high or they have bad reaction time or whatever. And your role in that team is either to cover their faults, right? To try to put together a better team, knowing their limitations and your own limitations. And two, training them and helping them become better players, right? So in that sense, even if you're in a team sport, at least for these smaller competitive games, you're still being measured on an individual basis by how well your partner does, right? Because to some extent, if your partner fails miserably, that is also in some way, shape, or form a shared failure on your part.
Right. Even if it's, you know, as abstract as, well, you should have played on the team with Jerry Rice, you know, like that sort of thing.
Or you know, you're also saying that it within the system, it's somewhat hard to measure that stuff, right? But
yeah,
and I guess this is where it comes back to competing against oneself. But if you understand that the system you're in is such that you have to rely on this other person, maybe someone not of your choosing, then you are not really competing against the other team, right? You're competing against yourself. Because, you know, we all know that there are people from freaking, you know, Tajikistan and stuff competing in the Olympics that don't have a chance in hell of getting a medal. They know that. We know that.
Yeah.
But they're still competing, right? Why are they competing if there's no chance at victory? There's something in it, in the very act of competition itself, that measures themselves more than it measures others, that must give them some form of satisfaction.
Right. Well, and that's what I think that's one of the things that I would modify about Bruckman, the professor that Bogost referenced earlier in the article. You know, when she was talking about, you know, creating a system of winners and losers and stuff, and like that's, you know, obviously that happens. Like, there will be people that are better than others regardless, but the idea, I think there's a larger problem is that you look at the losers, or maybe society looks at the losers as having no value whatsoever. You know, like, you didn't win.
That's why I look at the losers.
It's like, you know, second place is first loser, son, you know, like that sort of thing. And like, in a sport, that means less, I think, but in a system of education or something like that, like she was studying, that's a lot more, like, the consequences are much more dire, you know?
Right.
Like, if someone fails a class and therefore they're failed out of the AP classes and therefore they're failed out of the college prep things and therefore they're stuck in life, you know, like, relegating them as a loser is really harmful.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if their failure to perform was looked at as an opportunity to, you know, progress, or a lesson as to what happened, rather than just like, oh, okay, we culled that thing, you know, that's when it gets damaging. And I think, you know, a game is like one of the last bastions of acceptability to just really say, okay, you lost, that's it. Like, you know, anything that happens after this doesn't concern you anymore, you know?
Yeah. Because, you know, But I mean, in the game of Olympics, it does. Even in the game of competitive gaming, you know, like, if you start being really terrible at StarCraft, Curse is going to kick you out of their mansion, and you're not going to get a paycheck anymore.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think there's, once you scale up to enough, I mean, once money gets involved, basically.
Yeah. So yeah. I guess then, in that sense, competition is most pure when the only thing you have to lose is the game itself and nothing more.
Well, I mean, and that's why, going back to the Olympics again, that's why theoretically they're all amateurs, you know? Like, and
yeah, theoretically.
It's kind of a farce now, because all these people do is train. Like, they don't have jobs like normal people.
Yeah.
You know, their job is to be really good at this sport and then worry about what they're going to do for the rest of their lives after the Olympics. Yeah. You know?
But, you know, you hear people talk about that as though there's this assumption that either one, they haven't made that choice themselves, that they're not, they don't have some form of agency in deciding that's what they want to do for their, in their lives. Mm-hmm. And two, that like their lives are basically ruined afterwards. Mm-hmm. And for many, that's the case. But, you know, I've talked to, I mean, at least my partner, and of course that's terribly anecdotal evidence, but there are others who take, say, a competitive event like football or gymnastics very, very seriously for a huge amount of time of their lives and don't have regret when all is said and done. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully they pull out when they feel like they can still make a living.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also they, you know, what Bogost was arguing is that being so extremely good at one thing and investing so much into it fosters a kind of empathy with other people that are better at other things than you are.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's certain things. Like, for a time, I was fairly good at tennis. And that gave me an appreciation of how good people are at other sports. Or, you know, every once in a while, you try really hard. You know, like, you muck around and try to make, like, a little side coding project for yourself. And then you realize how smart people like Gabe Newell were, who made some of the early Windows operating systems.
Right.
You know, like, it gives you, like, you'll never be as good as them, but being invested in something fosters a sense of respect for other people. And, you know, I think it kind of dulls a little bit of the sting from seeing people that can just completely blow you away.
Because you know that they're not jack of all trades. They've got one, except for decathlon winners.
Well, and you also know how much sacrifice and how much effort and how fully invested they are in it.
Right.
You know, they just don't wake up and, you know, become Usain Bolt.
Well, but then aren't you suggesting then that part of the reason we enjoy it is that we tell ourselves that, oh, if we only devoted as much of our lives to what they're doing, we could be just as good.
Well, I mean, at some point you can be like, oh, I'll do the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 or 20,000 hours or whatever, and that could be a genius. But, you know, that's not very realistic. But you can understand, I think, if you, by recognizing people that are clearly better than others, you can appreciate why that is.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that's important.
I agree, but then doesn't the arbitrary rules make that worse? Because how long lasting is that lesson, right? Like, gymnastics today looks very little like gymnastics 40 years ago, right? And we could say the same thing about world records being shattered every year because a new swimsuit was invented or a new, you know, like, they've changed the metal composites in shot put balls, you know? Like, if we're changing the rules like that and we know that then our winners aren't, you know, lasting forever in the way that we measure them, then how useful is that knowledge?
Well, I mean, I think that's why games are one of the only places you can do that in. You know, games are a safe place, are a largely safe place for declaring winners and losers because it is completely human-made rules.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not everything is human-made rules, but, I mean, it is completely arbitrary rules that we are recognizing as contrived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, and I'm completely unlike this in, like, social and policy matters. Like, I'm the furthest you could possibly be from, like, a social Darwinist, you know?
Right.
Because the system is just too complex to declare winners and losers. Like, I'm no Andrew Ryan over here. Like, I'm going to build my space station out of the sea like a loser.
Yeah.
But, like, in a game, you can't say, you know, that person, or in Mortal Kombat or Street Fighter, is the winner. You know, we've had this, like, tangible argument using this very specific set of rules, and the result of that argument is that I lose. You know?
yeah. So if we were to take this into video games, then, you know, when we saw the recent news that BioShock Infinite.
Mm-hmm.
Is removing their competitive mode.
Mm-hmm.
Are we losing something from that, or, like, does it fundamentally change how you see a single player experience or a collaborative experience if you could know that in another circumstance you could be measured and found wanting or winning?
I mean, I think I was reading that same story and still playing, you know, somewhat seriously. Playing Dyad, which is only a single player experience, except, much like gymnastics, you're competing against all the other people that are playing on the same courses.
Right.
And similar to gymnastics, there are different ways to make your way through the level. Like, you can link different enemies together, and that gives you better boosts, but it might be more dangerous, so there's, like, a risk reward thing going on. But it's also this, like, you know, kind of trippy psychedelic game that, you know, is there to be enjoyed as this weird audio, you know, audio visual trip, you know?
Yeah.
And so I totally think that makes a difference.
Right.
You know, if you knew in BioShock Infinite, we'll never know, except through the magic of YouTube and the internet, who is the best skyline rider in the world.
Right.
And maybe that's not the point of the game. You know, maybe that's, like, a specific, you know, other than the economic and time frame reasons why they pulled it, but maybe that's like a philosophical reason why it's taken out of the game.
Yeah. It seems so strange to me, because if you're supposed to get this experience from a single player game and then you add that element, so in Dyad, right? Mm-hmm. Or Geometry Wars or any other sort of single player game with consistent leaderboards on the side, isn't there this feeling? Well, I guess two things come up. One is that there's this feeling that as you're playing the single player experience, you're always conscious that you're not quite as good as others. Like, can you not help but measure yourself even when you're playing that single player experience in a way that maybe you're not meant to when you're first having that experience? And two, that when you see scores that are beyond what you can achieve, you settle for not trying at all, right? Like, mm-hmm. we talked about measuring yourself and how well you do against a ghost of your own, a version of you. But, you know, in, Mirror's Edge. In Mirror's Edge, you can race against ghosts of other people who are way better than you, mm-hmm. right? And when you watch them do their trick, I think there's quite a few people who say, I'm just going to bow out because right. I can't ever achieve that. And now I feel like it's pathetic to measure myself against myself when it's so easy for me to measure myself against people who are so much better.
Well, I mean, I think you hit on what I perceive as one of the dangers of not normalizing the idea of having better people and worse people in certain mm-hmm. activities, right. you know, because like once you, if everyone thinks that they should be equally good at everything, then it's a really jarring shock when they find out that they're not. Mm-hmm. And if we look at people who are not as good, if we look at that as some kind of like, you know, moral deficiency or some kind of like embarrassing personality trait, like, oh, you only did 3 flips off the bar, like, get out of here, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Then that's where it becomes damaging. It's not like, it's not that some people are better and some people are worse. It's not that that's the bad thing. It's that how people are then sorted afterwards, you know?
Right.
It's that, and that does happen all the time. Like, people like take a look at that and be like, oh, why would I, like, why even bother trying is like the really dark side and the most unfortunate outcome to having a game where there's a clear winner and a clear loser.
Yeah, and part of that surely comes from a sort of cultural acceptance that if you fail, you are deemed less, right? Like,
right.
It's pretty rare for you to fail in any competitive event, you know, even in academic settings or school settings, right? When theoretically teachers want to encourage you to do your best at all times and other players be damned, mm-hmm. to find your failure, even when you tried the hardest, be rewarded with any form of praise. You know, usually it's like, oh, you failed, try this next time, or you didn't do X, Y, or Z, as opposed right. to, and maybe this is starting to sound a little bit more like, oh, we can do competitive events as long as everybody gets a medal afterwards for participation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's also something to be said for, you know, just kind of shifting your mindset into competing against yourself at the same time. Like, yeah. You'll never be, you know how many trophies I have in Dyad?
What, 5?
I have, no, one trophy in Dyad. That's good.
Why are you playing? Just stop, Scott.
And that's what I was thinking. I was like, okay, well, you know, what is the real point of this trophy? Like, and the real point of the trophy was I wanted to see if I could do it.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, that's kind of me determining whether I'm a winner or a loser. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I got my one trophy and died. And I was like, all right, good. I now completely respect everyone who is like, you know, fully platinuming this game, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, like, there's other, you know, there were other times when I was playing it when, like, I by some miracle dipped into like the double digits in the leaderboards, and it was like the hugest accomplishment. It was like the people that are just happy to get to the Olympics because it means there's, you know, they're yeah. like, you know, of the 99th in the 99th percentile of skill of the people in the entire world. You know,
yeah. I played an iPhone game called Cubes. Not many people have played it, but I currently rank number one in that, and I took a screenshot of it. I was so happy, and there is that joy. But you know, when we're talking about competitive video games, let's not deny the fact that most of the time, even if you find a small achievement, there's going to be somebody there to say, oh, no, actually, you're a total noob.
Right.
Like, you might get third in your Call of Duty ranking. That doesn't mean people who are first and second aren't going to call you out for being terrible.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but you know, again, you have to decide, whether your engagement with the rules as a single player, whether, you know, you succeed or you fail, whether you're okay with that, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. Go ahead.
I get the sense that Bogost thinks that competition, even in video games to some extent, is given a sort of second class eye from critics and from anybody who thinks about games seriously. And I agree with that. But part of that, don't you think, is due to the fact that culturally we're still not at that point where we can fail in certain spaces and actually feel safe the way that you describe, right? Like, one of his quotes from here is that he says, the problem with having winners and losers isn't that there are winners and losers. It's that we fail to respect and acknowledge all the different ways that victory and failure can play out while still taking seriously the specific conditions of a particular individual or group, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But when he says that we fail to respect and acknowledge, we're also including the competitors themselves, right? And like other people that aren't involved. Like, yes, it would certainly be great to have things work out the way you're talking about. But like, you know, when kids play dodgeball in high school, some kids are assholes. Yeah, and I think we should talk a bit about dodgeball.
Okay.
Because I'm a big fan of dodgeball. And just to go back to the three types of competition, I think dodgeball does a great thing in that it changes the type of competition it is as the game progresses, right?
Mm.
It starts off with a large team-based one where you know that, yes, you're relying on your teammates, but not all of them, right? Some of them are there just to be fodder. Right, it is not uncommon in a serious dodgeball game to use someone else as a human shield.
Uh-huh. So, a meat shield,
right? Like, the person who's being used as a meat shield, they don't think that they're in the game as a meat shield. That's not why they're playing the game,
right?
They think that, oh, I'm going to go in here, I'm going to be fantastic, without realizing there's some guy behind you that's just using you as a shield, right? And then as the game progresses and those people get knocked out, it becomes, more often than not, games amongst smaller groups of individuals, people who are much better than the others on their team. And sometimes, in a rare occurrence, it comes down to one-on-one, right? And it becomes that sort of table tennis competition where the stakes are so much higher and you are really now being measured not as a team but as an individual.
Mm. I mean, I think that, you know, part of the legacy of video games specifically is coming from those kids that did not like dodgeball at all, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, can we find a refuge from, you know, these games that only measure us on the physical ability, that we're totally called out if we're losing, and, you know, this is a different venue, you know?
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, most video games have very similar rules. Like, even if you're playing against a computer, like, there is still a leaderboard. You can see who's better and who isn't. Mm-hmm. It's how people are treated afterwards. Like this is like a problem for me anyway. This is not a problem of like, this is a problem of like social framing and social norms.
Yeah.
You know, rather than like a structural problem. Like, it's not bad that she was crying that she, you know, messed up at the Olympics. Like, it was clearly meaningful to her, you know? Yeah. The bad thing is if she was crying is because if everyone then kind of was going to forsake her, you know, like, that would be bad. Like you're out of the village.
Yeah, she was crying because she would never be able to go home again or something.
Right. And, you know, Bogost makes a joke about, like, you know, former Soviet bloc countries, and sometimes the ramifications are dire. And, like, again, that's a social problem.
Yeah. I'm really glad that Bogost calls that scene out, because it reminded me of this great quote by a journalist writing about female gymnastics. And there is a gymnast from Russia named Mustafina.
Mm-hmm.
And she's often referred to as a diva, right? And the author, I think, rightly calls out that more often than not, she's being called a diva because she just hasn't memorized the cliche line that she's just happy to compete in the Olympics this year, right? Like, she shows visible and emotional reactions when she loses and when she wins, right? Like, there's almost a sense of her gloating over her competitors, and then a sense of her feeling angry, right? Like, she shuns and throws off the comforting arm of her coach. And people see that as, oh, wow, she's being a diva, when really, yeah, I guess you could argue that she is being potentially overreacting to the result of the meet. But more importantly, like, she's showing an emotion that is completely natural, that to some extent we should say, yeah, of course you should be involved, you should be emotionally tied to the experience that you have, because it means that to some extent this game is a success, right? Like, we want you to feel tied to this competition,
right? And plus, she's 16, you know, like, I mean, but like, seriously, like, she is learning how to, like, you know, be totally invested in a system at a given time, but also have another part of your brain that's above that, you know?
Right, right.
And like that's, you know, the most admirable athletes out there are the types of athletes that, you know, even when they lose, come back out of the locker room and give interviews and have insightful things to say, even when things didn't shake out all that well, you know? And, you know, like that's, I think people coming at it from that direction and having more and more people talk about, you know, like interview people that lose, like just normalize it, you know, rather than flatten it all out.
Yeah.
It would be my, you know, would be my hope, I guess.
And I think that when you do interview someone who loses, you do get genuine insight from them. And sometimes it's personal insight that, you know, I tried really hard this time, but I was thinking about X, or I didn't keep my mind on the game. And you can sort of see that they know that they did what they did and they're okay with it and it fits. And sometimes you get insight about the game itself where they say, oh, this didn't work in this way that I expected, or they just played a better game than us.
Mm-hmm. Is there a specific game that you've either, like that you either really like that has really clear winners and losers, or a game that you just are terrible at but you still play anyway?
Well, besides dodgeball.
Besides dodgeball.
I mean, I really enjoy team sports. I think that there's something about that competitive experience when there are others that you can rely upon that helps diffuse the feeling of failure and loss, while also compounding the sense of success when you do succeed.
But do you have to be competing against another team, or can you just be individually measured on your performance, like how many rebounds did you get or how many kills did you get against bots or whatever?
I think, as we've established, like, you can have a great time, don't get me wrong, great time playing with teams against a bot. But it's an entirely different experience to play against another team of real players.
Right.
And I think that experience is something that, I mean, really everybody should have at some point. And if anything, that's the best thing about games and video games in particular, right? Is that there's always another one coming up. There's always going to be a competitive video game you can try out. And you might not be great, and maybe when you fail, you'll feel unhappy and quit and never play that game again. Yeah. But come a month's time, there'll be another one and another one and another one. And you can constantly put yourself in these situations where you try to experience and learn something from that competitive experience.
Yeah. And especially if you know, there are games that you play for a certain amount of time that you get really invested in, like for a while, like when I had to review it, and then in the like month and a half afterwards I was playing a lot of Awesomenauts, which is like a side scrolling MOBA game, and I was pretty good. Like, you know, I like prestiged, and like I was like learning all the characters, and then like I kept on playing, and like there was like obviously this critical mass of people that were all playing at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I realized that I was not good as they were, you know?
Right, right.
Like, and I played some really high profile matches. Like, you can see people's rankings and how long they've played and, you know, what they're doing and stuff. And it's like, okay, like I'm competing against these people that are like the best of the best. Let's see how that is.
You know?
I'm fully invested in this game. Like, I hate it when I lose, and I really love it when I win. And after knowing where you stand, I don't know. Like, personally, I just have this... Maybe it's a kind of sick fascination, or maybe it's healthy, but, like, this admiration for how good those people are, you know? Like, how keyed into the game they must be.
Well, and did you get a sense of satisfaction from thinking, I lost, but I lost against people who deserve to win?
Well, and also it's like, I now know my limits, you know, like I know how good I really truly know how good I was at this, you know? Yeah.
And does that make you more or less likely to continue playing?
I mean, I feel like as time goes on and I get older, I look at it much more philosophically, like on the long, you know, on the long,
the long
scale of things. It's like, you know, you could still have meaningful experiences, and it's okay to lose because, you know, the sun will come up again in the morning, right?
Right, because in the long run, we all lose.
It all everything trends towards zero, man. Like,
wow.
On that upbeat note, we'll open up the floor to all you winners out there. experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address if you want to drop us a line.
And of course, to give us victory shoutouts, experiencepoints.net is the website. That's where we play our competitive game of talking about games.
Is that in the Olympics yet, or is that another Brazil Olympics that I need to start campaigning?
Trampolining is an Olympic event, dude. Games criticism 2024, maybe.
Oh, we'll blogging see. On trampolines? I'm totally there.
And of course, leave a review on iTunes. That's how we compete with other podcasts, guys. It's so easy.
You don't
easy.
Want us to be losers.
Go on down, leave a quick review, leave a star rating or what have you, and yeah.
Tell us your experiences of if you've ever like reached either like a publicly recognized pinnacle, like any of you esports people, or just like a personal milestone, like you were, you know, the equivalent of the Olympics in your limited experience of a certain game, and what happened, and then how did that, you know, what changed you after that?
Yeah, and so essentially losers need not apply.
No, I want to hear, like, I love the romantic, I love the Rocky stories, you know, like, I want to know what happened when you reached the pinnacle, and then things didn't work out. Like, are you a broken man? Are you fighting Apollo Creed in the next match? Like, what's up?
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Okay, until next time, everyone, thanks a lot for listening, really appreciate it.
Yep, bye-bye.
Take it easy. Every time.